Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Three Trainings by Eric Weinberg. One of the earliest teachings given by the Buddha in the sutras is the teaching on the three higher trainings, ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. This talk explains how we progress in our spiritual path by applying these three principles on our meditation seats and in our daily lives. This talk is based on the book Minding Closely by B. Alan Wallace. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Okay, so it's been a heck of a week. Needless to say, Caitlin was around for midday meditation, I believe. And I felt like it was really wonderful. And then somewhere around 3 o'clock that very afternoon, our world got shaken in a lot of ways. Months ago, we had a gap between books, you know, where the meditation instructors, we had a gap. So they asked if anybody would have a subject they'd like to do a standalone talk. And I did. And this is that talk. And it turns out that the talk is about, in Buddhism, what is known as the three higher trainings. And this is derived from one of the original sutras in the Pali Canon that the Buddha himself taught. And those three higher trainings are ethics, samadhi, which is really the fruit of meditation, and wisdom. And in the Buddha's presentation, he actually said you really can't achieve samadhi without ethics, and you can't achieve vipassana, wisdom, enlightenment, without ethics and samadhi. So he was laying out where the door to this path to well-being is, and also laying out the path to getting there. So I feel like this is foundational and really important. And when I first, you know, you hear it all the time, ethics, meditation, wisdom. But when it really struck me as a really valuable prescription for my life, was when I was reading this book, which it's not hard reading, but it's not easy reading either. It's very, very authentic. So it's called Minding Closely by Alan Wallace, just so you know. And so between some other sources that are in the sutras and in writings by other teachers, and that this talk came together. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin this with actually reading a little bit from that book, and then I'll make comments about this along the way where it seems like it could be helpful. But before we start, it's always good, it's always actually very important to begin by settling into place and preparing our minds to be good, in my case, explainers, and in your case, good listeners to the Dharma. And the way we do that is by taking refuge, which in the Buddhist tradition is the way that we come back from wherever we may be right at this moment and identify with the deepest reality in the life that we have right now. And because that is so good, we kind of relax in a way that's open and bright, not in a way that's dull or agitated. So I'll just recite the refuge prayer in English three times. And the first time, relate to it as everything that appears and you see, all the phenomena you're sensitive to in your life, and realize that whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, whatever reaction you have to it, within all of that and beyond all of that, you have these three refuges. And the second time through, turn your attention inward and realize the same thing, that no matter how you're feeling, within that energy that is that comes with a precious life, these three refuges are there, always there. And then the third time through, totally relax and just be in the spaciousness of the comfort of the awakening of these three refuges. So until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I take refuge in the awakened one, the Buddha. I take refuge in the path, the Dharma. And I take refuge in all of those on that path, the Sangha. By accomplishing the six perfections, generosity, and all the rest, I vow to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings without exception. Until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I take refuge in the awakened one, the Buddha. I take refuge in the path to my own awakening, the Dharma. And I take refuge in the community that is also on the path, the Sangha. By accomplishing the six perfections, generosity, ethics, patience, joyful diligence, meditation, and wisdom, I vow to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings without exception. And for the last time, just relax in that spaciousness and I'll chant it in Tibetan. Sanje chudam so ki chug nam la Jung chu pardu dagni kyab suchi Daki jin so gi pe sunam ki Rula pinchir Sanjay Rupa Show. Thank you. So, to begin with, it's good to have what we call the view. And the view is that you already have, at the very least, the potential for enlightenment within you. That's not something you're going to go get somewhere else. It's already there. This is a process of uncovering something and not a process of pleasing some disembodied deity somewhere who's going to give you a boon if you get everything right. And that's important to understand. So in the Buddha's discourse on the four close applications of mindfulness, he refers to what are now known as the Vipassana teachings as the direct path to nirvana. Now, it's really important to understand what nirvana is, I think. So I'm breaking here. In the West here, because we are so marinated in this concept of heaven and hell and all that kind of stuff, we think of nirvana as a place where, you know, where we exist, but no troubles that come with this I, me, and mine person that's here right now. No troubles exist anymore. That's not exactly what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha was teaching is that it's possible to directly experience in this life, in any life that we take, it's possible to experience authentic well-being. And at the end of the day, isn't that what we're all motivated by? Isn't that what we want? We want to experience authentic well-being. So that's what the Buddha is talking about. And authentic well-being is a state in which suffering is utterly gone and doesn't even have a basis to arise again. So it's important to understand that when we talk about nirvana, it's slightly different from like a heavenly country club. Now, Buddhism, this is a sidebar, does posit that there are different realms and there are heavenly country clubs and all that, but that's not nirvana. Actually, it's considered a lower level than nirvana. The bliss of those places, because they're conceptual and created, is impermanent. So it's always subject to change. And boy, don't we experience that in our lives. We get to touches of heaven, such incredible happiness. And then, of course, we lose it by trying to cling to it and make sure that we keep it. And of course, we never can. I'm sure you all have a million examples of that in your own life. I certainly do in mine. So this idea of nirvana is different. It's this potential for authentic well-being, no matter what the circumstances. There, the people who originally taught me this, directly and indirectly, were Tibetan monks that were captured, tortured, exiled, made into refugees by the Chinese invasion in 1959. one of those monks, Garchen Rinpoche, I had the occasion to ask what was the worst part of being in Chinese prison, because he had been captured. And he didn't say it was the torture. And they would torture these monks for practicing Dharma and for other things. They were trying to break them and brainwash them and so on. And he said, the most frightening thing in my experience in that prison camp was that I might lose compassion for my Chinese captors. And he had the most serene, sweet smile when he said that. You could feel the love radiating out of him. And his bliss is intimately tied up with a certain freedom inside to live in love and compassion no matter what. So this idea, this path, how do we take this mind that's full of trying to deal with our craving for heaven and our avoidance, our running away from hell, and we're running and to and from all the time, trying to get what we want and avoid what we don't want. How do we deal with this mind that does crazy things, neurotic things, and only seems to cause more trouble over time? That's what the Buddhist path is about. The Buddha had profound insight into how to deal with this mind. And he had that insight because he walked that path himself. So when he says that these quintessential teachings are the direct path to nirvana, he's saying they're the direct path to authentic well-being, that no matter what the circumstances are at your core. Alan Wallace says a wide variety of meditations are designed to bring about various personal transformations, mental abilities, and other goals. The specific purpose of the four close applications of mindfulness is complete purification of all mental afflictions, leading directly to the realization of nirvana. This vipassana means insight meditation, is not a standalone practice. The path to the cessation of suffering, asserted in the Fourth Noble Truth, is depicted as a pyramid in traditional Buddhism. The foundation of the pyramid is ethics. Resting upon ethics are mental balance and samadhi, constituting a platform. And resting upon this platform is vipassana, which severs the root of mental afflictions. The ancient Pali commentaries liken shamatha to a great warrior and vipassana to a wise minister. The example is given of a wise minister authorized to negotiate with a wayward prince who'd fallen under the influence of evil friends, symbolizing the five obscurations. So what are the five obscurations? These are the things that cover over this already present well-being in no particular order. Sensual craving, malice or enmity, laxity, kind of like laziness, excitation in the sense of it being anxiety, and uncertainty. So those are the five obscurations. When you come across that term in a Buddhist text, you'll now know what they are: sensual craving, malice, laxity, anxiety, and uncertainty. So, if the minister attempts to admonish the prince by himself, he might be killed. We all know that when we see ourselves or see others that are deep into these things, these obscurations, well, they're going to defend their, they're going to defend themselves strongly. But the story goes on. If he is accompanied and protected by a strong warrior who first subdues the prince, then the minister can persuade him to change his ways. Similarly, the efforts of the wise minister of Vipassana are strengthened and protected by the great warrior of Shamatha. So this idea of practice every day is really, really important. How does this work? Okay. First, we start with this kind of ethical foundation. So, you know, that's like the king worried about his wayward son. So the ethics, the ethical foundation, you can, there are all kinds of formulations, but just to keep it simple and really purely in line with the sutra tradition, you say, the first, you've probably heard them all. The first precept is a disciple of the Buddha does not kill, but rather cultivates and encourages life. Two, a disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given, but rather cultivates and encourages generosity. Three, a disciple of the Buddha does not misuse sexuality, but rather cultivates and encourages honest and caring relationships. Four, a disciple of the Buddha does not lie, but rather cultivates and encourages truthful communication. Five, a disciple of the Buddha does not intoxicate self or others, but rather cultivates and encourages clarity. So those are the five main precepts. And it's important to note, following upon what happened last Wednesday in Washington, we saw how it plays out when the obscurations, you know, arise and there's no strong warrior in a sense, internal warrior in this case, to challenge these obscurations. We definitely saw malice and enmity. We also saw laxity and laziness. We also saw excitation and anxiety. We also saw uncertainty and fear. We saw killing. We saw much taken that wasn't given. We saw a lot of lies and the fruit of a lot of lies. And we probably saw some lowering of inhibitions, let's say, by intoxication, and certainly a lack of clarity. When we see that, out of our own sense of right and wrong, our own sense of justice, we can tell ourselves any kind of story we want. That's really true about any experience that we have. we can tell ourselves stories. So say we do something really right. Well, we can tell ourselves a story about that. Or say we do something really wrong. Well, we can justify it and we can tell ourselves a story about that. If we know what these five precepts are, that first piece of being able to really tell ourselves a story is shortcut a little bit, because we know in our heart of hearts whether we mean somebody harm or not. We know in our heart of hearts whether we're telling or believing or spreading a lie or not, and so on and so forth. So this ethical foundation is of extreme importance, because the platform that rests upon it, if you will, it forms the shape for the vessel of our consciousness. So if it's an ethical shape, if it's a shape that's beautiful and helpful, and not only doesn't do harm, but actually benefits others, not only doesn't steal, but is generous and so on, the shape of your consciousness kind of takes form. And sooner or later, you know, the shape of your consciousness and that container that it rests in, these precepts become one thing. And there's a deep relaxation with that. And in a sense, the first piece of this well-being that we're talking about can begin to be experienced. Then we add to it samadhi. Now, when he talks about samadhi or meditation, we're talking about shamatha or shine, a lot of words for it. But what that means is we spend time every day training our minds to drop thoughts as they arise, and to drop the stories about those thoughts as they arise. And as we do it more and more, and that becomes the habit, those thoughts, whatever they are, even if they're these thoughts that are obscurations, don't have a way of taking root in our minds. And we become stronger and stronger. And because the power of the mind is virtually limitless, science agrees on this, and the clarity and luminosity is virtually limitless. Scientists also agree on that. Well, we have a really, really very, very powerful instrument, okay? And that's the piece of shamatha. Shamatha on its own isn't sufficient to reach this ultimate well-being. But it gives us the power of letting go of a thought. One of the things that I've learned teaching meditation in prison, I've heard this multiple times from various prisoners. They say things like, "This is the first time I've been grateful for being in prison since I got here." And I say, "What do you mean you're grateful for being in prison?" And they say, "Well, I never would have learned this on the street. And this idea that I can let go of a thought is the most powerful thing I've ever heard." Now, we're talking about people who are used to guns and thuggery and fighting and all that. And they're acknowledging that having this stability, this platform of being able to recognize a thought, let go of a thought, let go of the story they're telling themselves, because there's basic goodness underneath all of that, because you have this potential for awakening under all of that, this is a really powerful thing. So you can see when the king sends his wise minister and the warrior to find the wayward prince. You can see what's happening here. That warrior, no matter what comes up, they can look at it directly and drop it. And within that space of having dropped it, insight can step in. That's the wise minister. And in insight, brilliant things come to mind through inquiry and inspecting and asking deeply and requesting for help and all of that. So you can see that all of this working together in a well-trained mind can indeed logically bring about this sense of well-being. So in a way, when you look at when you look at what happened on Wednesday, for yourself, the first thing is to recognize whatever kind of uncertainty or anxiety might have come up in you, or what kind of celebration, if you liked what you saw, no matter what it was. If you really want to know the truth of it, you need to be able to drop that and get some insight. And with that, you'll recognize that these are all human beings. They're just trying to be happy. They've told themselves a bunch of stories and created a vessel for their consciousness based on those stories. And their consciousness has taken the shape of that. And all those actions that they took, just like for all of us, all the actions that we take, create some of this vessel that our consciousness is in. In a sense, if you're doing harm, if you're lying, if you're stealing, if you're involved in sexual misconduct, and so on, you're just making your own bed and you will lie in it. It's sort of creating a very narrow sort of hellscape for yourself. So out of that sense of realizing that they've done great harm to themselves, we have to take wise action. We have to support wise things. So the first thing is we have to send out some kind of wisdom and a warrior that can stop that process of harming. And we do it out of compassion, not out of anger or reactivity. But, you know, sometimes you've got to keep somebody from harming themselves. I've had a couple of prisoners, I learn a lot from these prisoners who've gotten out after serving their terms. And there are more than a few of them that have gotten involved in stopping people from their own old life from continuing to do what they do, because they've come to understand that that's the compassionate thing to do. So we can take that and we can work with it, and we can know how to pray for our country and pray for those that are so upset that they're willing to inflict harm in order to effect change. So that's obviously a sidebar. Alan Wallace says it's unrealistic to think that without any development of ethics and samadhi, one could still practice insight meditation and achieve the same result. But how ethical do we need to be in order to create a stable foundation for samadhi? What degree of samadhi constitutes an effective platform for practicing vipassana? To me, these crucial questions are not raised often enough. Many people practice Vipassana simply to cultivate mindfulness, serenity, and harmony in their lives, which is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with using Vipassana methods to relieve stress. A question was posed to the Dalai Lama in 1990 concerning the teaching of basic mindfulness practices that were radically decontextualized from the framework of Buddhist theory. Without ethics, without samadhi, not even attributed to the Buddha. Did His Holiness think that teaching these mindfulness practices was a kind of plagiarism? And the Dalai Lama answered, if following these practices helps people to simply alleviate stress, even without the framework of ethics, samadhi, and the larger worldview, this is a good thing. All the Buddhist teachings were given in order to alleviate suffering. Even if people derive only a fraction of the benefit of His teachings, simplified practices can help alleviate their suffering. But then the Dalai Lama added this precaution, just don't mistake it for the Buddha Dharma. A radically simplified, decontextualized mindfulness practice without ethics or samadhi is only one small aspect of the vast framework of Dharma. How important is the issue of ethics? To pursue the practice of Vipassana effectively requires proper supporting conditions. For example, if you're sick and you take prescribed medicine following all the dosage, dietary, and exercise requirements, it may yield a complete cure. If you don't follow all the conditions of the prescription, it may only result in temporary relief. So it follows to ask, so do we all have to be monks? And in the sutras themselves, the answer is clearly no. There were followers of Gotama, the Buddha, historical Buddha, who were not monks and actually achieved this state of absolute well-being. So being a monk isn't the important thing. That's not necessary. Being a monk is supportive because you take vows, and so those precepts, that ethical foundation, is just easier to build your life around, but you don't have to do it that way, for sure. He tells another story that I liked a lot. He said, there's an interesting corollary here. As one's quality of life becomes refined through developing increasing mental balance and samadhi, the mind becomes finely tuned, sensitive, stable, and clear. Then as insight develops through the practice of Vipassana, one finds something quite remarkable taking place. One becomes increasingly sensitive to one's own mistakes. Even while avoiding any blatantly negative behavior, one becomes acutely aware of the pain caused by one's subtler mental afflictions, insensitive comments, thoughtless acts, and innocent gaffes. A classical Tibetan analogy says that for an ordinary person, the arising of a mental affliction, such as craving or hostility, is like a hair falling on the palm of one's hand. Its presence is barely felt. On the other hand, for a person who's advanced on the path of developing insight, the arising of the same mental affliction is like a hair falling into one's eye. It's quite intolerable. So this is an important thing that I wanted to say about these precepts. We're used to thinking of such things like the Ten Commandments. It's like, do this, don't do that. Some kind of religious rigidity. It's not like that. What happens is that they evolve with us. They evolve as we evolve. As we evolve, we become more open, more sensitive, because we just see things more clearly. We see the connections more clearly. And the precepts are designed to unfold as we do. The basic statement of them is clearly something that we do as a starting point. But, you know, if you start with doing no harm to yourself or others, that's good. And, you know, obviously you refrain from getting into fights. And then pretty soon you realize, at least I have, if I get into some arguments about things I feel passionate about, let's say that uncertainty and anxiety comes up and I'm arguing a point vociferously and I want to win the argument, sometimes I'll say things I shouldn't say. Sometimes I'll say things I don't know that a lot of people can't figure out are just something I made up. And I can fall into all of this stuff. Well, at first, when I avoided a fist fight, let's say over something like that, at the end of the day, I would feel okay about it. You know, I still won the argument, but we didn't end up in taking physical blows. And then, you know, as things went on, I realized I had to make shit up in order to win that argument. Not so good. And then I realized sometimes things about this relationship or my opponent's, let's say, psychological makeup would become the issue. And I kind of wounded them psychologically in order to overpower them. And I realized that's not so good. So this idea of doing no harm isn't like thou shalt not kill. Well, of course, thou shalt not kill. That's a good. But it's beyond that. It's a way of encouraging us step by step to expand on this no harm feature of the container for our consciousness, and to build that and to beautify it and cultivate it and enhance it. Because what we experience through meditation, and this is sort of the supremely important point, is that there are kind of three factors. We have this body, and it has what it has in this lifetime. You know, we all have our own qualities. We all have our own weaknesses and so on and so forth. And the sensors in it, the six senses that take in all the information that we ever process, right? Unless somebody in the room is beyond the senses at this point, which is very cool if you are. I'm not. Pretty much all the information we get comes through the five physical senses plus mental consciousness. That's it. Whole nine yards. And that's what we mean by body. Now, all this information that comes to us, what we see, what we hear, what we touch, what we feel both physically and mentally and so on, taste, smell, you know, all that, it comes through this device, this sensor. You could think of it like this, obviously, this camera and this computer that you're seeing me through. Well, you sort of see a representation of me, right? I mean, I'm here at my house and you're there at your house. And the image of me hits this sensor and it turns it into electrical energy and sends it off into the World Wide Web. And you've tuned into that particular strand of information on the World Wide Web, and boom, I appear where you are. Amazing. Well, everything's like that. So if you look around your room, what you see is something that actually is in your own mind. It's not out there, it's in here, because it passes through the sensor of your eye and then is interpreted and worked with by your consciousness. And that consciousness is like, if you think about it, can take in anything that these sensors bring to it, anything. So it is open and it has clarity. And since it can take in virtually anything, it's truly limitless. It has extraordinary qualities. Well, it takes a form. It gets embodied through your relationship to those things that you take in. In Buddhism, we talk about body, speech, and mind. I like to think of body as that set of sensors and containers and stuff like that. And then speech is relationship. It's through speech right now that we're relating. You know, it's also self-talk, the way we relate to ourselves. And what it means to purify body is to settle down enough to see, to use these sensors in the clearest way possible. What it means to purify speech is, okay, we take in this data and we have a reaction to it. At the very, very point of reaction, if we're practicing shamatha, we learn to see that's there and we can drop it and open the space back up. If we don't drop it, we'll either like it, not like it, or be neutral towards it. So we'll have a judgment there. And then once we recognize we have a judgment, we can drop that. Or we don't. Once we have a judgment, if we don't drop it, then we'll tell ourselves a story about it. And the narrative goes on and on. And if we don't drop that, we get trapped in this, what shall I say, story that we're telling ourselves. So in shamatha practice, in this platform practice, what we're doing is we're working directly with that mechanism. And what the Buddha called the cause of suffering, which is craving and clinging, as we know. So in our craving, we try like hell to get things we like, or try like hell to avoid things we don't like. That's craving. I crave to have this. I crave, deeply desire to be away from that. And the clinging is the story, okay, that makes it more and more attractive or more and more unattractive. If we get deeply, deeply lost in these narratives, obviously, we crowd out this spaciousness. There's not room for insight to come up. That's why samadhi becomes the powerful platform for insight, for vipassana. Ethics gives us this frame where we don't create extra noise for ourselves, which is why the Buddha said, hey, you know, that's the first thing, is to put together an ethical life. what we're doing is creating conditions for ourselves where we don't have to make so many stories up to tell ourselves and cloud our consciousness. Usually when you do something unethical, you got to justify it to yourself. And then you tell yourself a story, and it's because of this and because of that. And I have this grievance or that grievance and so on and so forth. Pretty soon, brain's pretty clouded. If you take this simple ethical approach to life, though, you know, there's not many stories to tell yourself. Wonderful. That helps your samadhi, helps your shamatha. And then once that samadhi is sufficiently stable, you can begin to inquire into the real nature of your being. And if you believe that first thing we talked about, that you have the potential for waking up, and that's the essential nature of your being, you now are on the path. That's where you enter the path. And so all of this dharma is sort of leading to the path. Dharma doesn't have a good translation into English yet. Some people translate it as path. It's really not. The word in Sanskrit for path is marga. And so in order to enter the path, that means now you've seen it. You've directly experienced your own potential. Nobody can convince you otherwise. There's essentially a change that happens that's irreversible. Okay. So that's where I, for instance, feel like I'm heading. I'm following the Dharma because I want to get to the path, to this path to authentic well-being. So this whole teaching, all the teachings of the Buddha hinge on this, and they all begin with ethics in order to create the conditions, the container for mind that isn't going to cause a lot of these problems, these obscurations. And in that condition, we can learn to deal with what else comes up, you know, our neuroses, our mental afflictions, and so on. And once we get skillful with that, we become strong, you know, warriors, as the story goes, then we can begin inquiry fearlessly. In my mind, that's what's meant by the phrase, the lion's roar. At that point, you know, there's not anything that's unworkable. And as you work with it, through the blessings of your teachers who are indispensable in helping us find the door and get on the path and guide us on how to walk down that path, and through the blessings of the teachings themselves and the blessings of our companions along the path, we can begin to experience a little bit of bliss. No matter what the external conditions are, no matter what. And that's sort of the object of the exercise here. So just to finish up, I want to make a couple connections for you of these five obscurations and the meditation practices and experiences that are antidotes for them, that help dissolve them. So the first one was sensual craving, which of course relates to sexual misconduct. It also relates to taking what's not yours and so on and so forth. And the antidote, the meditation antidote for that is single-pointed attention. What does that mean? Well, single-pointed attention is what we develop as we practice shamatha. And that's because we're constantly practicing dropping a thought and returning to the breath, for instance. if it's breathing meditation, dropping a thought and returning to the breath, dropping the story about the thought, returning to the breath, we get the mind used to being able to stay settled on one point, on the breath. So now nothing can come up that's going to shake us. We can remain single pointed. That's an incredibly strong and useful tool. Malice, this idea of enmity, well, it only ever comes up because we're uncomfortable, right? And we're just fighting it. So the remedy for that is well-being. And as it turns out, practicing meditation universally brings about states of well-being. That's why a lot of people have tried to strip Buddhism out of it and just practice meditation, which, as the Dalai Lama says, is okay. Well-being is a good thing. But that's actually an antidote. When we feel well, enmity doesn't arise. Okay, so laxity, laziness. The remedy for that is called course examination. And course examination at our stage of the game, there are different levels of that, but our stage of the game can simply be contemplating these five precepts or contemplating the four thoughts that turn the mind, you know? Like, I have a precious human birth. How is this blah laxity reflecting this preciousness? You can see already, well, it doesn't. And therefore, it can be very useful to contemplate precious human birth. The second thought is impermanence. Things change. So if I just sit here doing nothing with my life, how is it that I'm creating the causes and conditions for the change I would like to see? Well, I'm not. And so it's, you know, motivational. Karma, cause and effect is the third, you know, that's the causes and conditions piece also. How am I creating the causes and conditions for something wonderful to happen for myself and others? And then the last is called the defects of samsara. It's my favorite one because it's the defects of samsara contemplation is about how am I buying in to the illusion that samsara is ever going to give me authentic well-being, which is what I really want. I mean, can that next thing that I buy really bring about lasting and authentic well-being? Yeah, no, you know, and you can. So this course examination through contemplation can help us with our laxity. Anxiety. Well, the antidote for that is bliss. So if you practice authentic Dharma, I promise you, you will have some glimpses of bliss. And if, and that will actually cause your anxiety, at least temporarily, to subside and disappear. And at the very least, then you'll know that that isn't the steady state of your being, this sense of anxiety and excitation, but you can live in a sort of untainted joy that's quiet and open, as opposed to contracted and tight. And for uncertainty is precise examination, and that's where we get into really deep Vipassana practice. Not, these obscurations don't totally disappear for a while, even after we get onto the marga, you know, onto the irreversible path. We still have to go a ways. So meditation continues to support our evolution. It also supports the evolution of our understanding of the precepts and so forth. Anyway, I'd like to leave this here and encourage you all to take everything to the cushion. And definitely bring everything to the Sangha. You know, we can't see each other in person right now, but we can email each other and we can join together in conversations on Zoom calls and whatever. And I think that's a really important thing to, I think that's a really important thing to take advantage of. So, I didn't leave any time for questions and answers, but I'll extend it if anybody has some questions or comments for a couple of minutes, and then we'll dedicate the merit. So if you have any, fire away. Well, if not, so let's dedicate the merit in this way. Just take a breath and feel the openness of your heart. The fundamental goodness that's there, the warmth and light, the openness. Imagine that all the qualities of daylight, of sun and moonlight, the stability of the earth, the power and humility of water, the brightness and warmth of fire, and the spaciousness and essential nourishment of air are all there within you, literally. In every cell of your body and in the space between the cells and so on. And recognize that there isn't an atom in the universe that doesn't also contain these things. We're totally related, connected through qualities. An unbreakable connection. And so take that light and offer it to all beings without exception, to the whole universe, as a blessing. And dedicate the merit of having come here and listen to this today in that way. Thank you, Caitlin. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.